Welcome to another edition of the Untold Patriots Stories podcast with Scott Prusak and Dave Usher, where you'll hear stories told by the players and media members.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Untold Patriots Stories podcast. Tonight, we have longtime Boston sports personality and sports reporter and anchor on Fox 25. So if you've been around in Boston and you've heard any sports, you've probably heard Butch at one point or another. So, Butch, thanks for joining us tonight.
I like the long time. That just means I'm old.
Yeah.
Experienced, well, we say.
And seasoned, right?
Yeah, seasoned. A little more seasoned than I want to be.
All right. Well, Dave, why don't you kick off the podcast?
So I know it's a Patriots podcast, but since we're talking about experienced, I have to talk about your first job was producer for Bob Gamier. Talk about longtime Boston, you know, Boston guy, sports guy, candle pins for cash. So what were you, a producer there? How did that come about? And how'd you get started?
Yeah, so, I mean, long story short, I knew what I wanted to do when I was 15 growing up in Braintree. The Red Sox were in the World Series 1975. You young people do the math. It's not pretty. But and I knew what I wanted. And so I started my own cable show when I got out of college. And then I was kind of naive at the time, and I didn't want to leave Boston. I didn't, you know, I heard all the stories. You got to go to a small market. You got to pay your dues. And I was like, no, I'm just going to get a job. So my buddy Billy Fairweather, we became best friends. I got right out of Fitchburg State, and he was Bob's producer. And we became friends, and I was like an associate producer for them. But I worked with Bob, and then later Frank Malicote and Mike Crispino, Scott Cohen, so many amazing people. Channel 56 was a great place to start. But I'll tell you this about Gamier. You know, people can say a lot of stuff about him, and he was a crazy man at times, but he was the best sportscaster I ever worked with. He would, keep in mind, Dave, this is before the internet, right? Before cell phones. And I would walk in and Gamier would have three TVs going, and I'd look at him and he'd be on the computer and say, he's not even paying attention to the game. And I'd mumble that one time and he goes, 3-1 Bruins in the second. So-and-so has goals. 5-4 over here with the Red Sox. And I'm like, oh, jeez. He knew exactly what was going on. So he had one saying that he always said to me, which always stuck to me. Make it sing, Butchie. Make it sing.
There you go.
That's nice.
So starting off with something current. So what is your take on the news that came out Sunday that, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about this being the last stand for Belichick, and all of a sudden a report comes out saying he signed a long-term lucrative contract. What are your thoughts on how the year is going to end? Do you think that makes a difference? I mean, they're saying it's kind of like a golden parachute for him. What are your thoughts on that news that came out?
Well, let me ask both of you guys a question in response to that. When have we ever heard anything, even just a morsel, about Belichick's contract, except for the fact that he's probably the highest paid coach in all of professional sports, right?
Right.
So, I mean, to me, it's shocking that somebody reported details about his contract, because the only people that know about his contract are Robert Jonathan and him, in my opinion. Linda Holiday may have known before, but supposedly she's not in the mix anymore. Right. So what do I think it means? I think it means that there have probably been a lot of things going on behind the scenes with his deal that we've never known about. I don't know if it's year to year. I don't know if it feels like to me, I'm kind of skirting your question and giving you my opinion, so I'll give it. It feels like to me that Belichick does have the golden parachute, that that probably several years ago, Robert Kraft left it up to him. Bill, it's your job until you want to leave.
Right.
We're not going to fire you. We're not going to let you go. And while things mounted quickly in the 1-5 run here, you know, I'm sure there was some pressure, but I don't think Robert's going to go against that. So if they did sign him to a multi-year contract, like people are saying, oh, it was an extension, oh, it was a new contract, there was none of that wording in there about that. So I don't think we should be surprised because, or we should be shocked actually, because we've never heard anything about his contract. So, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, weren't we just a week ago before they beat Buffalo thinking that, okay, are they going to win three games? Right. And should they win three games? Should they go for the top pick? And now all of a sudden, after Miami, which, you know, they're playing the Chiefs the week after that. So maybe on top of everything else, they got beat up by the Eagles. They're playing the Chiefs next week. Maybe you got a shot at them. Right. But let's say they lose that game, right? They play Washington, Indianapolis, the Giants, the Chargers, the Steelers. Those are five winnable games all of a sudden, right? In our minds.
Yeah.
So who knows? I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if they're a 500 team at the end of the year going into the Jets game, needing to win that game to have any sniff of the playoffs. But who would have said that 2 weeks ago?
So my follow-up question to that would be, do you think they gave it to the wrong person? Because basically, if they gave Belichick that contract, right?
I know where you're going.
That's basically what Brady asked for. So do you think they might made the right decision by not giving it to Brady, but giving it to Belichick? Or do you think it should have been the other way around?
No. No, I don't think they made the right decision. I mean, not only because he won a Super Bowl after he left, right after he left, right. But just I think it really comes down to Kraft learned a hard lesson when Bill Parcells challenged him, when he decided to pick Terry Glenn and the famous press conference, you know, you want to cook the meal, at least they should let you shop for the groceries, right?
Yes.
So, and he stuck to it. So I believe, and again, none of us know it. There's been so many books written about it and everything, but none of us know the exact details to why Brady left. We do know by all accounts, and I actually heard from someone who's involved in all of it, that Brady wanted 3 years at $25 million a year. He said he was going to play till he was 45. If people have been listening to him, he had always said that. Mm-hmm. And that's what he ended up doing. And he ended up getting that contract somewhere else. So should they have given him the money? Of course they should have. But it was Belichick's decision, I think, because Kraft left it up to him.
It's funny that you said before about what a difference a week makes. And I'm glad we're talking to you now instead of last week. but you know, that was one of the first things I thought of was so much for tanking. You know, I went into that game for the first time in 20 years saying, don't know that I care so much if they win. I mean, I was still screaming at the TV when a good play happened. So I still got it in me, but part of it was saying, wow, you know, do they need to be set up for the future? But everyone's been saying it, you know, he needs a signature win. Mac needs a signature win. Now, this didn't automatically make him a good quarterback, but at least hopefully they say he might have been losing the locker room. You know, does this give people some more confidence? What do you think on your dealings with the team? Do you think that helps the locker room?
Oh, I'll tell you this. That was their first home win among everything else, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And doing those losing locker rooms, it's no fun for anybody. And everybody feels like they have to ask a tough question. I mean, the guys don't even want to talk to you. And you're asking them these questions about, you know, your confidence and your leadership and your blah, 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 blah. And they're like, you know what? I just went through a train wreck. Okay, I got to climb in the ice tub for the next 16 hours, and I really don't want to hear it. But that locker room Sunday, I wanted to be there. They were like, come on, bring them on. Give me the question. I actually walked up to Jack Jones, and he was sitting at his locker, and I said, this is the first thing I said to him. So let me get this straight. You haven't been playing and they've been losing, and now you played and they won. So it's all you, right?
Yeah.
And he laughed, and by all accounts, I don't really know him well, but he's a, you know, borderline cocky kid. So he said, well, yeah, I guess you're right. So, you know, Dave, back to your point about Mac. I mean, look, he needed to do it, and I think you were onto a really good point. He needed to do it for the fans. He needed to do it for the owner and the coach is, you know, Billy O'Brien and Bill and everybody else. And he needed to do it for himself because, you know, he's still a young player, but it's been 3 years. We all know the debate before last Sunday about Mac, but all of a sudden, I thought Greg Bedard said this really well today. He said, look, he had his moment. And Greg pointed out Aaron Rodgers when he had his moment, when he was losing the locker room, when he took over for Brett Favre. and some other young quarterbacks who had their moment. Now, Brady's moment happened to come, and then there were many more after it, after the first Super Bowl. But he had his moment. Now it's let's see what he does with it. So absolutely do I think this can boost his confidence, boost his teammates' confidence. I mean, they don't want a quarterback who's not confident. They don't want a quarterback who can't do it. But now they've seen him do it, right? Doesn't it make all the difference in the world?
Yeah. Did you see the – I'm sorry, I was going to say, did you see Gesicki posted the touchdown and on social media, and Kendrick Bourne responded to it and said, "You saved my career, man." I mean, so
– No, I did not see that. Yeah.
Yeah, so those – you know, so it shows you how much it means in that locker room because, you know, after he lost the ball, which was – you know, that was a tough hit. That was a tough play, but still – you know, he's going to get some blame for that. And then, you know, it's all erased after they win.
I tell you, I love Bourne. I really do. I love him on the field and I like him off the field. I like the way he handles himself. As a matter of fact, we asked him about the fumble and he was smiling and laughing and joking. And all of a sudden we asked him about the fumble and he just said, "Man, that is so bad on me. I'm not a rookie." He said, "I was trying to make a play like I always do." He was just being really honest. And he said, "But in that situation, I got to know better. I got to know better." And, but it says to me too, that was the only turnover they had all game. Now it almost lost them the game and Max saved his butt. He did, but he was just, he's just genuine, you know, that's
just
all
like
we want.
Devontae Parker.
Yeah. He didn't say what he didn't say. What did you see?
Yeah. What did you see?
Oh, I would have cut his ass right after that press conference.
I'm with you, Dave. You know, the other, I always think about this. People say, Boston sports fans are different or better or whatever, right? I mean, I've worked in my career in Chicago briefly, Minneapolis for a couple of years, and Detroit. And fans are fans. They're provincial. They're, you know, the difference here is that we're, in places I've been, we're almost exclusively a pro sports town.
Yeah.
And when you go to Dunkin' Donuts or, you know, wherever you go in the morning for breakfast, usually – they're talking about it. Yep. You know, people are talking about the game last night and I don't think it happens that way or the way it has, but again, we're biased. So I guess what I'm leading up to is when you're talking about Bourne versus Parker, we're pretty simple as sports fans. Just talk about us. Look at how much we love Kyle Schwarber because he pretended he was from Waltham for like a week. Yep. You know, I mean, we're pretty simple. That's all you got to do is act like you're one of us and you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. So my question would be, so, I mean, you've seen a lot of quarterbacks, Butch, right? Mac Jones had a good game. I mean, was it against the Buffalo team that's having its struggles a little bit? And then do you see him being the long-term answer? Because we're getting to a point where the decision has to be made. And do you see, because we're talking 3 years now, and he's shown just as many times that there aren't those leadership characteristics as far as mannerisms on the field, you know, kind of pouting. Do you think he's the long-term quarterback for the Patriots?
I don't think anybody can answer that with authority. I don't think Mac Jones can answer that with authority. And I'm not trying to avoid your question because, you know, look at Raymond Berry chose Tony Eason over Steve Grogan, and he almost lost his locker room because of it. And at the time, Tony Eason was from that 83 class, one of the five with Marino and Elway and everybody else. And Tony was an efficient, probably would have been a better quarterback today than he was back then because the game was so different. And there weren't a lot of things he couldn't do. He could throw the deep ball. He had a touch. He could run. But, I mean, compared to Grogan, Grogan was a warrior. Eason, John Hanna, you know, looked at Eason wearing a skirt every time he saw him.
Yeah.
So what did we know about Tony Eason? He ended up being okay. If he was on another team, he might have had a different career than the way it worked out in New England. I guess I'm using him as an example because I don't think anybody knows what Mac Jones is going to be. And I will disagree a little bit with your point, you know, that at the time is now. Well, I assume you mean at the end of the year. We got to decide after 3 years, right? Not really, because they got to pay him, yes. But they don't have to give him a long-term contract. They can have control of him for the next 2 years if they want. I mean, it's probably going to be $35 million a year, but, you know, with a franchise and then another one the next year, which they can do. So they don't have to give him the $200 million contract or whatever yet. Now, if they win out and they end up 11-5.
That's a whole different story.
Excuse me, 12-5, 17 games now, right? That's Brady redo.
Right.
So I don't know. Again, I'm not trying to avoid your question. I mean, I'll throw it right back at you guys. If you had to make a choice, is he the guy for the future? And let's frame it this way. We all agree none of us know, right? But what do you think if you had a crystal ball? Like if we're doing this time next year after seven games, had they gone to the playoffs? Did they win a playoff game? Maybe get knocked out. And now all of a sudden, are they 5-2 instead of 2-5 and Mac Jones their quarterback? I could see that happening. I could.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think if – so here's the problem now that you face. So Belichick has never been an offensive coach. So I think if it didn't happen to him last year that did, and Belichick actually surrounded him with some top-notch talent, we could be talking about a different Mac Jones. So I think a lot of this is going to depend on if Belichick is the coach next year. I mean, would you want – and if you do keep Jones, draft another quarterback, keep Jones for another 2 years, 3 years – let somebody develop behind him. But I mean, I don't know if I'd really want Bill Belichick to be developing the coach, the quarterback that we're trying to get ready to replace Mac Jones.
So let's go to the crystal ball again. Let's go to week seven next year. Is Belichick the head coach? I mean, yes or no?
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
No. Why do you say no?
I just think there's a lot of things pointing in the direction of him not being around next year. Like even with the contract, it could be, it's his out next year and he's still going to get his money and be able to leave on his own terms. I we're basing a lot of stuff on Buffalo, and that was one game. And you got to see how the year plays out, like, the crystal ball thing. But there's been so many things that have pointed in the other direction for Belichick, I think, leading up to this game. That's just the feeling I get. I mean, I think Kraft knows it's almost time for a change. I think the time is – at some point, you got to hit the reset button, right? So, I mean, how long are we going to wait to hit that reset button, I guess, would be the
– Well, Dave, how about – I feel like I'm running the show now. I'm asking you guys all the questions.
That's all right. So, hold on, Butch. Let me change this. Welcome to the Butch Stearns podcast.
I'm kidding you,
Butch.
I know. Dave, what do you think? Is crystal ball this time next year. Is Belichick the coach? Is Mac – the quarterback, and we're feeling different about him after all that time?
I'm going to take a step back before I answer that and just say you may be able to tell that Scott's the negative one on this program. So I think he was rooting for this. He didn't sleep well after the win. I'm just saying. But I would have said prior to this contract thing that Belichick may be looking at, taking some time at this point. Talk about the crystal ball. I think it's going to play itself out. I mean, so there's no excuses now, right? Max on supposedly on the same page with Billy O. There's your offensive mind. No more excuses. Like Scott was saying, last year was a cluster. But now he should be able to do that. And the biggest thing that we haven't talked about is the offensive line came together a little bit. Now, is that what's happening? So if Owenu's going to move over to the right side and Strange is going to play and all of a sudden he gets some time and we're seeing the emergence of Pop Douglas and Kendrick Bourne finally being out. He was out there for 50 something snaps and he's a guy when they didn't utilize him last year. And we think it was because he was in Patricia's doghouse. And I know he was one of the few guys they didn't move in the offseason who had a few things to say in the locker room, but because he was so talented, they're finally starting to use him. So, I think, especially like you said, for another 2 years, Max probably the solution. Should they be taking the old philosophy, whether it's Belichick like he used to or not, of getting the next man up and getting the successor ready? Absolutely. I think maybe he was burnt out when Brady just never stopped being good.
Right. Well, Dave, if I summed up everything you said, you sort of echoed the point we were talking about before. 1 week, boy, 1 week does really make a difference, right? Mm-hmm. And then I thought of this after the game to try to simplify it in my mind, stuck in traffic, heading back to the station. I'm like, okay, so Like you said, all the things you said, the offensive line played better. They got Pop Douglas involved. Look what a difference he can make. Yeah. See the next Edelman, Welker, whatever, right? Kendrick Bourne played more. Duh, that's what we all wanted all along, right? Yeah. The defense did not sit back and let Josh Allen just pick them apart. They blitzed them more than 50% of the time.
Yeah.
I heard a stat today. They had 13-0 blitzes, all out blitzes against him. I mean, and they had him running all over the place. That was a factor in the game. But really, if I simplified it, it's pretty simple. They led 10-0. Mm-hmm. That was only the second game they've led this year. And that was the Jets game that they won. They only had one turnover, and it was a forced fumble, not a giveaway and a pick six, right? Yep. And it didn't happen until crunch time, but they played almost a flawless game. I forget how many penalties they had, but it wasn't the 10 they had against the Raiders last week. So I think really going back to Mac Jones, what it all leads up to is right now, despite his great comeback, and he's got a pelt, as Bill Parcells used to say about quarterbacks, he said they're trappers, and they got to get the pelts. I remember he said that about Bledsoe when they were going into the 97 Super Bowl. He doesn't have that big pelt yet, but he's got a pelt. Well, Mac's got a little fur, right? You got a little squirrel fur or whatever.
A stole or something.
Yeah. What I think we know is, at least for 1 week, he didn't need to have big weapons around him. He didn't need to have better coaching. They didn't need a better roster. The offensive line didn't need to be better for 1 week. And I think you got to give him a lot of credit for this one reason. Again, Greg Bedard and I were talking before the game, and Greg just said to me, what do you think about Mac? I said, what do you mean? He goes, oh, just give me your 2 cents. I said, well, there's one thing, it's unfair to compare him to Brady, but there's one thing that's so anti-Brady-like that I don't like. He acts like he's panicking all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He's like, he's in the huddle and he's rushing things. Even like there'd be a play and they screw it up or they're, you know, delay a game and they got another full clock, right? And he's rushing them in the huddle. That conveys a whole different thing to the rest of the offense.
Absolutely.
But you know what? You go back and watch the game from Sunday. There was a calmness about him.
Yeah.
He was at least for one game. So, I mean, I'm thinking of the conversation I had before the game because Greg said to me, he goes, well, do you think that's something that's innate that he'll never get rid of? Or do you think that can be a learned skill? I said, that's the ultimate question. I don't have an answer for you, but it's kind of ironic that after that game, I think that was a huge factor in them winning his composure, his poise, whatever you want to call it. To me, I'll call it his calmness. He was calm and in control. That was his game. And yeah, he proved it by that last drive.
So do you think, because a lot of people are saying that was the first very well-coached game of the year, do you think that those game plans came out of, you know, listen, we're 1-5 right now. So, you know, these are desperate times. I mean, I guess to come up with a game plan like that so late in the season, do you think there was some sort of, all right, you know, with Belichick and the coaches, all right, guys, we really got to start turning this around because, you know, it's getting ugly. So I guess, how do you come up with such a great game plan? And with six games into the season?
I'll give you a two-part answer to that. One, I really don't think the game plan going in was much different than what it's been under Belichick forever. I mean, sometimes with Brady, you remember that Monday night game against the Vikings when they came out and threw it like 21 times in a row and everybody was saying they're going to stuff it down their throat. But the game plan has primarily been based on a balanced offense, run it half the time, throw it half the time, right? And they wanted to run. They really didn't, for as great as the offensive line was protecting Mac, they had a lot of negative running plays. So I don't think it was the greatest game plan. I do agree that they got different personnel involved. You know, they threw to Kendrick Bourne. They had Kendrick Bourne. Ezekiel Elliott, he's been a great pickup.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's had a better season than Ramondre Stevenson right now, but Stevenson showed up yesterday too. So I'm not nitpicking with you about the game plan, or maybe I am, but I just think they just executed better. They made better plays than Buffalo did, you know. And then we could go off on that tangent. Does this game say more about the Bills or the Patriots? If it's a Bills fan, you better hope not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because that game was there for the taking, and they took it. And let's be honest, the Patriots under Mac Jones usually haven't done that.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, you can argue the Eagles game, the Dolphins game, the Raiders game were all there for the taking, and they weren't man enough to take it. Yeah. They were on this one.
Well, talking about men enough being man enough to take it, you've been around for all six Super Bowls. let's talk about some fun stuff now. So what's one of your favorite memories of a Super Bowl or maybe covering one of the games? What really takes you back, makes you smile?
Look, we as Boston sports fans, I don't think any city will see the 20-year run that we had, right, with all the teams. So there's so many of them, but it's hard to not start with the first one for so many reasons. I mean, in the significance of the dynasty and the 20-year run of all the sports, that started it. Yeah. I mean, people have always asked me, what's your favorite championship in Boston? And I'm like, it's so hard, but it's the 01 Patriots. It's not the 04 Red Sox. I said, see, there you go. How can it not be the 04 Red Sox because of the 86-year curse? Right. You know, the I felt it. It was on our air and standing there, and we were in a commercial break. And they said, when we come back, you just take it. You give a sign off. And I said something from the heart about, I thought of all the people that had never seen the Red Sox win the World Series in my family, my grandfather, my aunt, who was a diehard Red Sox fan. And then, of course, the next day, I'm not saying I started this, but I wasn't the only one thinking that. How many grave sites had Red Sox hats everywhere? But, I mean, do the Red Sox do that if the Patriots didn't put the pressure on?
They think the same thing, right?
You know? So I'll give you a personal story from the 01 Super Bowl. It's kind of a funny one. So in my experience, is getting on the field after big football games, especially a Super Bowl, is almost impossible because they hold you back and all this and that. So the Patriots, we all know how that game went, but they're winning at halftime. And I'm the local Fox guy, and Fox is broadcasting the game. So I go down and talk to the network guys. I have one of the network guys bring me to the place where we're going to go on the field. And there's a big, burly, handsome security guy, just like you, Dave. And big, burly security guy, right? And he looks at my pass. He goes, he's a local guy. He goes, he's good. He can get on the field right after the game. Because I'm thinking to myself, they're winning at halftime. Yeah. What the hell happens if they win, right? So I get down there as Brady's driving. And I'm watching from behind. And I look at the guy and I go, you remember me, right? He goes, nope. And I go, what? And I realized right away he was playing the bouncer routine. He knew who I was, but he was not going to let me on. It's okay. Right. So Adam Vinatieri lines up for the kick. I turned to my cameraman, Bob Goodell. I said, Goody, as soon as that kick leaves his foot, follow me. I'm running. So as soon as the kick left his foot, I ran. And the guy turned at the same time. And I hit him in the shoulder. I bounced off of my, my Stoneham College football days. I did a little spin, and we got right on the field. Guy tried to chase me. He fell. He was about 250 pounds. Big loom lying on the field right there. But I get on the field. I get up to Adam Vinatieri. We're like one of the first ones there. I stick a mic in his face, and there's a Spanish reporter asking him a question. He had just kicked the field goal, and he said, ¿Dónde está casa de field goal? And Adam goes, yeah, we won. Like, right. Yeah. So, but there were so many of those stories because it was just, we all lived it, I'll tell you this just in general, people would say, oh, you got the best job in the world. I said, look, I loved it. Don't get me wrong. I was able to be there for all of them. But most of those moments, I was leaning against a concrete wall, watching a 10x10 television on a delay. When 07, when they lost, I heard 12 seconds before I realized what happened. I heard Plaxico Burress catching the go ahead, the touchdown. I heard the crowd screaming, all the Giants fans, and so it's not, I'd rather be sitting in my favorite, establishment or home on my couch watching those moments.
You want to be a Canes?
Well, no, right now at this point. I mean, I used to be in the bar business. I was a silent partner in some places in Boston. So those days are over. But the Braintree Brew House, which is a mile from my house. Okay. And I can stumble home from there, and I often do.
So we talked about your favorite Super Bowl. So all the years covering the Patriots, who was one of the most favorite plays that you covered during your career?
For me, the 70s, 80s Patriots were my guys. I mean, I'm 63. I graduated high school in 78. you know, Pete Brock, Steve Nelson, Steve Grogan, Tim Fox, that whole crew. And so I'm proud to say that I've done a ton of charity events with all of them. I just did one for the Hockomock YMCA yesterday in their golf tournament. And I still pinch myself that I see those guys. But then when I came back to Boston, I was gone from 92 to 96, and I came back with Channel 68, which was owned by BU, and they had the Red Sox. But that year was 96. That was when they Parcells took them to the Super Bowl and then flew the coop for the Jets. But I had a show called 68 Sports Night. It was sports radio on TV. It was hard to do every night. But I had a limo company. I used to pick the Patriots players up on Monday night. I'd bring them to my show. Then I'd send them to Chow Bella right above Daisy Buchanan's so they could have a good meal. And then they'd go right down to Daisy's. Oh, we had it down pat. But yeah. I got to know all those guys. I got to know Bledsoe, every one of his offensive linemen. I got to know Ted Johnson. I got to know Ty Law. I got to know Lawyer Malloy. So those guys were fun to cover, and I still have friendships with them. You know, I golfed a couple times with Teddy. He brought Mike Vrabel out. So I saw Mike this weekend, and, you know, yeah, it's cool. You get to know those guys, but they were solid guys.
Yeah.
Like they wouldn't speak out of turn, but once I got to know them, I'd ask them about something, and they might not give me a yes or no answer while they were playing. You know, they would say, yeah, you might want to pursue that. Yeah. Or they'd say, nah, you're way off base with that. I go, okay. All right, good. And then I learned, and when I was on the big show back then, I learned to go on the air and not say a Patriots source and not say I was talking to an ex-player or a player. I would just say it. And that's why I'd get hammered, like a lot of us, on the Weiner line.
Oh,
yeah, they'd call me Bullworth. That was my nickname.
Yeah, I remember that.
But I'd get hammered because, and you guys know this, I mean, you know, you have your podcast, you have a voice, and all of a sudden you start getting some responses from people. I'm like, wow, they're not only listening, they're kicking my ass. So you learn to be thick-skinned about it, and you learned, Will McDonough taught me this years ago. You know, I used to get information from somebody, and he'd be like, oh, you're going to get so excited. He goes, as soon as you get that information, as soon as you hang up, take a piece of paper out and say, who can that information hurt, and where's the money coming from? He goes, that'll lead you to a bunch of other questions. Call that other person right away. They'll give you their side of the story, which is completely different. And then it's up to you to decide where the truth is, which is right in the middle somewhere.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, as a reporter, you would always – I mean, you must have had people that if you wanted to find something out, you off the record, you would go to, right? I mean, any successful reporter has that, right?
Yeah, but I think I built respect by – I spent a lot of time going to their charity events and stuff. You see guys – you know, a little different, and you get to talk to them and know them a little different. You support them. And then when you got to know them, yeah, I would ask them stuff, but I wouldn't put them on the spot. You know,
it's funny you say that because Karen Grigian gave that same answer.
Yeah. Karen sources are loyal.
Yeah.
They love Karen, and she's earned every Karen. And I look around and we do this all the time. And I never say how old a woman is because I got three daughters in my family. I just want to do it. But if I go to a press conference these days, if Dan Shaughnessy's not there, if Bob Ryan's not there, which he usually isn't, if Steve Buckley's not there, and if Ron Borges isn't there, and Borges hasn't been around for a couple of years, I'm usually the oldest guy in the room, but I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
Karen said that to me. We were in Buffalo last year. She goes, you think anybody's as old as us? And I go, no, they're not as good as us either, Karen, so don't worry.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Exactly, right?
That's true. You both are great. But it's funny. I think we had that same talk with her at the beginning. She said something about, yeah, I'm seasoned and not old or something that Scott said, but made me think of that. So I do – I'm going to go off of the Pats talk for 1 minute just because I know what a fan you are, and Scott has introduced me to it now. Scott is the only person I know close to you as a Springsteen fan. So how many concerts you've been to?
Dave, hold on. And Scott will tell you this too. That's the first question you always get. That people want you to prove how much of a fan you are by how many
concerts. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So Scott, you and I can answer very quickly. Do you have an exact, I don't have an exact number.
I've been to a lot.
Is it over 100? Is it over 100?
No.
So you're not going to believe me, but it's been over 200 for me.
Holy wow.
Yeah, and I know that because I stopped counting at 200. And people say, how's that possible? Actually, I went to the two shows here at Gillette, and they did a story on our website for it. And the young girl came up and interviewed me. She said, how many shows you been to? 50, 40? And I go, no, it's over 200. How's that possible? I go, well, do the math. I saw him first in 1975. And then I saw him four times in 1978. And even though that's 45 years ago, even though he hasn't toured every year, I saw him 50 times alone in the Born in the USA tour. So do the math.
Wow. I'll tell you a funny story.
No, go ahead.
So I went, me and Dave actually went to the first night down in Foxborough. And so I was, you know, I've seen him. I love every show. So I was actually, I was outside. I think I was waiting for Dave to get there on that Saturday. It was Saturday and Sunday, right? Or Friday and Saturday, whatever it was.
No, it was Thursday and Saturday.
Saturday, yeah, because it was a night off. So I was outside and I ran into Mike Reese. And I said to Mike, I go.
Mike's a diehard. Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I said, there's still pit tickets left. I said, Mike, we got good seats tonight. I said, but just answer me one question. If I have the ability to get a pit seat, whatever you want to call it, standing room only, and I've never done it before. As a great Springsteen fan, what do I do? And I said, and even if I go alone, he goes, Scott, if you're a Springsteen fan,
he goes, you're never alone.
No, he goes, you get that pit ticket, and he goes, and I'm going to tell you another thing. He goes, once you do that, you're never going to sit in the seat again.
That's true.
And I will tell you, he's 100% right.
I got to be honest with you, Scott, and I'm not trying to make you guys feel bad about the Thursday show, but he was sick, remember? And then that was his first show back after being sick. And the Saturday show, there was a different, like he,
oh yeah,
I think he, like he kept going song after song after song. I just felt like he never mails it in. So I'm not saying he mailed it in, but I felt like he wasn't 100%. You know, I felt like he was playing hurt, so to speak, that night. Yeah. And it was a little different because he came out on Saturday. And I was with some buddies, and one of my buddies, who's twice as big a fan as I am, knows everything. He opened with Lonesome Day, and he had never played it on this tour. And Ricky looks at me, and he goes, we're in for a good night. And I was like, yeah, we are, and we were. And I had my wife and three daughters there that night in the pit. I'm not going to tell you what it cost me, but it was great.
So he did another song, too, that I had never heard before. I forget, it was I don't know, it was like halfway through the concert, and I didn't even know the name of the song. It was like a very rocky song. I can't think of it. But
I can't remember either.
But the funny part is, you know, Zoe's a friend of the show, and he was always gives Scott a hard time about being a Springsteen fan, even though Zoe goes to Taylor Swift. So go figure.
Right.
So Scott said, you've never seen Springsteen. He dragged me to the last time Springsteen was at the Garden. And just for fun, I brought the red bandana and put it on. And he goes, all right, I got to take a picture and send it to Zoe. And he's like, oh, you're one of those guys. It was my first ever concert. Now, you know, I went to the other one too. But I had to bring that up because I know how important it is. And while we're talking football, but you and Scott, I don't want to say live for the guy, but definitely enjoy his talent. So
yeah.
Yeah. So I'll tell you one funny Springsteen story. We, for the last, 10 years, let's say, through friends, I've just been able to go backstage probably about 20 times, right? And I always had one rule when I went backstage and got to meet people, and I did. I got to know family members of the band members. And we had a friend that worked with the band. My first rule when I walked in is don't screw this up. never pulled out my phone, because I've been to so many Boston sports championships where the average fan gets in. When the Red Sox won in Colorado in 07, these two guys got in to the hotel party with the Red Sox and their families, and they're fist pumping each other. 10 minutes later, I had Jason Veritek had the two of them by the throats, holding them up. All the security kicked them out, and they were standing outside looking through the window. And I was like, you idiots, how do you get kicked out of this party? You morons. Right. And they probably never told their guys they got kicked out, you know? So anyway, we were backstage. It was a show in Hartford. He had played a European tour. It was his first show back in America. He had like 2 weeks off. And at the Hartford Civic Center, it was really tight behind there. And we're all standing around. And usually about 15 minutes from the show, guys like us have to leave. And our buddy tells us, we're walking, you got to go. So he has these two loyal people, Bruce, Barbara Carr, and George. George's last name is escaping me. He's from Lexington. But anyway, George was there. He goes, no, they're with us. They're good. So we're standing around with about 10 people, and the dressing rooms are right behind us. And George says, why don't you guys all talk about the first time you saw Springsteen? So it's going around the room. Now, whenever anybody asks me that question, I have two stories. I have the true one, which is I saw him in 1975, and my buddy's brother bought me. I was 15, and I was hooked. And the one I make up. So the one I make up, I decided to tell. The one I make up is, I saw him in 1974 in Harvard Square at Jonathan Swift's. My buddy Steve Pratt, his older brother Boo, brought us there. I'd never been in a bar before. We snuck in the back door. There was smoke everywhere. There was a guy with a beard on the piano playing Thunder Road, and I was hooked. And they're like, Tommy Boy, that was awesome. Right? So George taps me on the shoulder and pulls me aside. He goes, Butchie, great story. It's all bullshit, but great story. And I go, what do you mean it's all bullshit? He goes, I met Bruce in 74. He did play Harvard Square, but he never played Jonathan Swift's. It was the Harvard Square Theater. He goes, that's when I first met him, and I've been working with him ever since. But keep telling the story. You tell it with such enthusiasm.
So I got to ask you, have you met him?
Twice.
Yeah, I met him. Do you remember when he did the book tour a while back?
I didn't do that. I didn't got to meet him either. Did you do Broadway?
No, I didn't. So.
Yeah. So did you get to talk to him when you did the book thing?
Yeah, I did. Got a nice picture with him. And it's like I told Dave, it's, you know, when you hear somebody sing and, you know, you appreciate them as much as you do. There was a girl in front of me, and I'll never forget, and she's all nervous. She's sweating. And I'm like, listen, he's just a normal person. Just what do I say? Just say you enjoy his music. So they had this thing where you hand off the phone, right, to somebody, and they take the picture. So now she goes, and now I'm next, and I'm like, I'm starting to, like sweat a little bit. I'm starting to get nervous. And I'm like, I'm telling her she's all right. And I'm thinking, what am I going to say when I get up there? And when you actually have a conversation and you're not hearing him sing, you're like, it's so surreal because his voice is the same. It's that, you know, that gravelly.
Yeah.
And he stuck his hand out. He's like, you know, what's your name? And he said, my name's Scott. Oh, pleasure to meet you, Scott. And I remember just hearing the voice. And then I walked away and I was like, did that really happen? Because
right.
I always tell somebody of his stature, if you think about it, somebody of his stature to do a book signing,
yeah,
charge you $30. You get to take a picture with them and get the book autographed. And the line went around. It was a bookstore, and
yeah, I remember it.
It went around the building almost twice.
Yeah,
and he.
So for those coming in to our podcast right now, you're listening to the Born to Run podcast with Dave.
Untold Springsteen stories.
Yeah, Dave, get us back on track. We got you do your final one, and I'll have my final one for Butch. So yeah, we'll all right. That'll be a conversation for another time, Butch.
This will have a great soundtrack anyway. So it's called Untold Patriot Stories, even though we've been talking about Springsteen for a while. So what we do is we do ask our guests, you know, do you have a story that people would only hear from you if they heard it here, you know, in your time? It could be funny. Do you have anything Patriots related that?
Okay. So since it's untold, I'm going to tell it. I actually just told this story on the golf course yesterday with a bunch of guys about Mike Vrabel, since he got inducted into the Patriots Hall of Fame.
Cool.
So back in the heyday when they were both playing, played a round of golf with a good buddy of mine, and I told Teddy Johnson, we had played a couple times, why don't we go down to Waverly Oaks because he lived on the South Shore. I'll just meet there. You bring your friend. So he brought Vrabel. So, and I knew Mike, but I really didn't, you know, he was guarded with me. So anyway, we go to play golf, and this was like March or April, March, May. It was like rookie mini camp, and Belichick had asked Vrabel to come to town early. Like the veterans weren't supposed to be in 2 days later because he wanted him. This is now, people don't, you know, think Belichick thinks like this. He knew all the rookies were going to go out. So he had them set up. So they had a van and they, you know, were going to go in Boston and not get arrested, but he wanted Vrabel to go out with them. And he wanted to find out about these guys, right? So Vrabel had been out all night with these guys and came golfing on like 2 hours sleep. So, and Vrabel's a really good golfer. He grew up in a country club court on a course in Ohio. So he pounds the first drive, and then all of a sudden he's spraying the ball everywhere. And I go, what the hell's wrong with you? I heard you were a good golfer. He goes, I only got like 2 hours sleep. I said, wow. He goes, I'm with these guys. So we go up to one of the tee boxes and Teddy goes, so who are you out with? So he starts telling the story. And of course, the story goes, he's with all these 20-year-old guys. Next thing you know, they're on Lansdowne Street. And next thing you know, they're behind the red ropes. And next thing you know, there's a lot of females around and blah, blah, blah. And in the middle of the story, there's nobody in front of us, nobody behind us. He stops. And I got my back to him. And I turn around and I look at him. And he's looking up at me. And I go, oh, you can't tell the story because the media guy's here? Screw you, Vrabel. I said, screw you, okay? Don't come golfing then, right? And I get up and I hit my drive. He hits his drive. He starts walking. He goes, so anyway, we're behind the ropes. And then he just broke into the story and finished the story. So there's a untold. And after that, he used to come in here at our station without asking permission of Stacy, which is, you know, and him and Teddy used to come in and do my Sunday night show then. And those guys were awesome. Great guys. Great guys.
So we don't get the rest of the story. What happened behind the ropes?
No. That's not That's not the untold story. That's the bail story.
Oh, okay. All right.
There you go.
That's well, like we've yet to hear. Everyone keeps referencing this story of Scott Zolak in Mexico. And the,
you
like
know
five
that one?
Different, they,
oh, and, in Mexico City?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they played the Raiders?
He must have been playing, yeah.
Yeah.
No. This was just a couple years ago when they...
Oh,
they
no, played no,
the.
No. I don't think.
Yeah,
so.
They played. No, they played the Raiders in Mexico City. They played the Broncos first. Yeah. Then they trained at. They stayed out there and they trained at the Air Force Academy because of the high altitude that we're going to experience in Mexico. And then, because I know that was a 12-day trip that I barely survived, and Zoe was on that trip, and he was out with us one night, and we separated, and I didn't see him. So I cannot speak from authority what happened to him after a certain point in time.
Yeah, so Zoe's thing is that'll be a story he tells us over a beer, but yeah. So, oh, man. Yeah, good stuff. Well, Butch, I can't thank you enough for taking some time tonight. I really enjoyed this, especially talking to Bruce, too, and Patriots. But so tell us, you know, if somebody hasn't followed you on social media, where can they find you and what are you up to?
You know, people reach out on Facebook all the time. I'm not a big Facebook guy. I'm a Twitter guy and it's my name at Butch Stearns, STEARNS. And, you know, that if you want to reach me, you can go there. You can even send me a tweet and say, hey, I'd like to connect with you. And then I'll follow you and then you can send me a direct message or whatever. And, you know, I'm sure you guys went through this too. I mean, when I was younger, so many people helped me out. I said before, like Will McDonough was, I was one of many, but he ended up being one of my main mentors, took me under his wing. And so I, you know, friends now with their kids and other people, they get sent to me all the time and I didn't need to hear, oh, you look good on TV. I needed to hear, this sucks, and this sucks, and that's why you're not going to get a job.
Right.
You know, so they did it for me. So I always try to connect with people, and I tell them, you know, tell your son to reach out to me. Here's my email address, and here's my phone. Tell him to be persistent. Yeah. Sorry, my lifestyle is a little crazier.
Oh, yeah. You know. You're always on the go. So
yeah,
that's what happens.
So before we wrap it up, why don't you tell us a little bit about the AFS Memorial Fund?
Well, that was So my father's name was Arthur F. Stearns II, and my name is Arthur F. Stearns III, and the F stands for French, Arthur French Stearns III. How the hell did you get Butch out of that? Well, it's a quick sidebar story. My mother was pregnant. I was the first of the whole bigger family to be born, and my father went to Norwell High School, class of 17. He used to brag that he was third in his class. I thought he was brilliant. I'm like, 17 kids in his class, you know? But anyway, he grew up with a guy named Butch, who he apparently hated. And while my mother was pregnant, I was in her belly. All his buddies were busting his chops, saying, little Butch is in there, little Butch is in there. And he's like, don't call him that. And I guess it stuck. So I had some Oedipus complex with my dad, I guess. I don't know. But my dad was a self-employed stonemason, worked at the Plymouth Quarries in Hingham. And there's three in my family, me, my younger brother, my younger sister. And in 1987, when I was 27, he was only 54. He was killed by a drunk driver with Dusty Allward, who was not only the Randolph fire chief, but he was the head of the firefighters union in the Northeast He was like Mike Dukakis's right-hand man. And I mention it because I've never seen anything like Dusty's funeral. It was on the front of the Herald and the Globe. But we lost my dad and Dusty in their 50s, and it was horrific. So at that time, my dad was a golfer. We knew as a family we wanted to do something to remember him, but we had no idea what we were doing. And I was going to do scholarships. And then my cousin, uncle, so to speak, Anthony Spadia, said, let's go have lunch. He said, don't do scholarships. I said, what do you mean? He said, you can do scholarships if you want. He goes, but do a general fund. I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, just raise money. Get through the first one. And if it keeps going, keep raising money and you'll find people that can use the help. Like you'll find. And so I'm proud to say 36 years later, we ended up taking a couple of years off because of COVID, primarily in Braintree and on the South Shore, but we've done it everywhere. We help out one or two families a year and we bring them to the tournament. And I do a ton of charities and they're all worthy causes. But when the reason ours has gone on for so long is, yeah, how tragic my dad's death was when somebody dies young. I mean, Tim Wakefield, 57. My dad was only 54. But they see where the money goes. And they look at a family with a kid with, you know, cancer at 3 years old or whatever. And they're like, that could be me. So they're like, what do you need? You know, they overbid on everything. So it's kind of cool that, you know, most of the people in that room now never met my dad, but they're helping to continue his legacy with me, my brother, and my sister. And so that's the Arthur F. Stearns Memorial Fund. And I don't know if we're still going to have another one next year. I keep saying no, but I keep getting talked into it. So I think we're going to go to 40. 41 was my college football number. So we'll probably go to 41, you know, and then I'll find a reason to go to 50. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, count us in if you do it.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry,
you guys are in.
Sorry for your loss. And you're doing,
thank you.
You're doing great things with it. So that you should be proud of that.
Thank you. Thank you. We are.
All right. Well, I guess we'll wrap that up. And Butch, best of luck with everything. And hopefully we can get you back on again when they rip off wins the rest of the year. And we can talk about them going into the playoffs, right?
You heard it.
Absolutely. Count on it. Just give me a little lead time. And it was great talking with you, Scott and Dave.
All right, Butch. Thanks, Butch. Have a good night.
All right. You too.
Thanks for listening to Untold Patriot Stories with Scott Prusak and Dave Usher. Please follow us on whatever platform you download your podcasts and be sure to tell your friends.